On today's Josh Nason's Punch-Out, I continue my look back at the year that was in pro wrestling in the year 2022, stopping in May. It was a May punctuated by, let's just say, people being upset. Some people deciding to walk out, and some people threatening to walk out, and not really sure what's going on with them. Of course, I'm talking about MJF with AEW, and Sasha Banks and Naomi with WWE. We talk about that. We talk about CM Punk winning the AEW World Title, Roman Reigns' schedule changing with WWE, and of course, every other single thing that happened in the month of May. Helping me do that is returning Jesse Collings of WrestleNomics and also Voices of Wrestling. It's a great conversation, as they all have been, so let's get right to it. Jesse Collings and myself talking about the month of May in the world of pro wrestling on today's Josh Nason's Punch-Out. Well, the Year in Review series continues to roll on here in May, and rejoining me, as he did a couple times during the last session we did last year for 2021. That's right. I can't remember what year it is. Jesse Collings is back. Jesse, welcome back. Good to talk to you again. And obviously, we got a chance to see each other a couple weeks ago at AEW Dynamite in beautiful Boston, Massachusetts. So say hi to the good people. How are we doing?
I'm doing good. I really appreciate you asking me to be back on the show, Josh. Feels like 2022 went by extremely fast. Mm-hmm. I was looking at a lot of these. You sent the notes over of stuff that happened in the month of May, and a lot of this stuff was like, oh my God, this only took place in May. This has been going on for 7 months.
Yeah.
So far, I couldn't believe some of the stuff that has happened. It's just. I probably said the same thing last year, but it was such a whirlwind of news, especially over the summer, which is typically a slower month for news, just in the news industry in general. The fact that it feels like May feels like stuff happened on the whole timeline of 2022, I think, might be fascinating when you look at some of the biggest stories of the year and kind of the impact that they had on our perception of how much time has gone by since throughout the year.
Yeah. And what I found with the WWE stuff specifically, especially in these first four that I've recorded, is you kind of know what's coming with the Vince stuff, right? You kind of know like the end of the story. And you're kind of seeing all these little, you know, machinations and things like that. And you realize that even though, you know, Nick Khan is around, that there's just, it's this way that Vince did stuff. And now it's completely different. You know, you see, you know, we're going to talk about like with the tag team title unification thing where everything was just, it was like on, off, on, off, on, off. Finally, last second, they decided to move ahead with it. Whereas this current regime, there's at least optimism that that wouldn't happen. That there'd be a little bit more of a thought process, hopefully, and things like that. So it's just kind of, it's interesting seeing how some of these things in that light of knowing what was to come, how they were handled just a few months ago, and obviously the massive sea change that would come in just a few months later.
Yeah, and there's certain, some like Vince-isms. I'm looking through this list of like, oh yeah, that's a Vince decision. Yep. And while I think Triple H has been overall pretty conservative with how much he's changed the product over his first few months in charge, there are some obvious things on this list where I'm like, oh yeah, that was quickly reversed when Vince was no longer in the picture.
Exactly. So let's start with WWE. So again, we're covering the month of May. I reviewed 516 headlines for this session. So all types of interesting stuff here. So again, we kind of start off, there were three big things with WWE throughout the month that really stood out to me. Obviously, there was Backlash, which, you know, is not a, you know, not a major pay-per-view or anything like that, but it's kind of just, again, the follow-up to WrestleMania. You kind of start to a lot of rematches and so on, but you see a few things here or there that are kind of interesting. Rhea Ripley joining the Judgment Day stable. Of course, Ronda Rousey winning the SmackDown Women's title. And then there was a storyline injury explained for Charlotte Flair, essentially being afterward, and that was due to cover up the fact she was taking time off to get married later in the month to Andrade. And obviously there was a Bloodline trios match as well, and there was this talk that, you know, the tag team title unification was going to take place at this show, and there was discussion about it, and they said, no, the six-man was always planned for this. And so it's just kind of a, you know, not a major not a major event by any means. You know, kind of the biggest thing is Rousey picking up the win. Any thoughts about Backlash before we get into some of this other stuff?
WrestleMania Backlash.
WrestleMania Backlash.
To get that nice SEO optimization for people to get talking about Backlash by throwing in WrestleMania in front of it. You know what's funny is the first thing you wrote down is like Rhea Ripley joins Judgment Day. And that was one of those things that like I was talking about before. I was like, man, Rhea Ripley's been in Judgment Day since May. Judgment Day has been around since May. And it did kind of, that was kind of a trip. It feels like it's gone by so quickly. And I think part of that is the Judgment Day stable kind of went through a number of incarnations until they've kind of found the more sustainable, better incarnation now with Finn Balor kind of as leader and Edge no longer being in charge. But it was a long time ago that Rhea joined the stable. It wasn't a super notable. You know, this year, one of the themes I feel like of this year is, you know, Roman Reigns not having many title defenses and WWE being okay with not having world title matches on pay-per-views. I think that's a theme for 2022. I think, you know, and obviously it was the case when like Brock was the champion and Brock wasn't going to be on every pay-per-view, but it does, I think there is kind of a different kind of philosophy now within WWE when it comes to, we don't have to have our world title defended on every pay-per-view. We can kind of have these, you know, few defenses spread out throughout the year, and each one will hopefully feel like a really big deal. And I thought that was kind of a message that was sent, especially after WrestleMania, where you had a lot of, like Roman Reigns wrestled on shows. He wrestled on Survivor Series, of course, but he didn't put the title online. And I feel like that's something that really wouldn't have been considered, you know, even a few years ago.
Yep, well put. So the much bigger news, obviously, was Sasha Banks and Naomi walking out of Raw. And this was a thing that broke, you know, basically just around the time that the show began. Again, just a random Monday night like any other night in May. And then all of a sudden, there's word that they walked out. WWE issued a statement. And then there was all the follow-up from it. And obviously, we're, you know, in future months, as more stuff comes out, you know, we'll talk more about the follow-up. But the immediate stuff, there was a... Corey Graves had made some comments about the two on Raw, and then Carmella, or his wife or fiance at the time, I can't remember, you know, had to kind of defend him. Pat McAfee also made some comments. He needed to explain those. We learned that Naomi at the time was in negotiations for a new WWE contract, and that the two were suspended indefinitely by WWE without pay. The tag team titles were vacated. Their merchandise was pulled from shop. This all kind of happened in the days after. And really, this was, you know, the two were frustrated with essentially a creative plan leading into Backlash, if I'm remembering the sequence right. Basically, they were upset with creative and how there was, it was something to do with, like, they were going to have the two be in individual matches. I think one against Ronda Rousey and then one against somebody else. And they were going to lose, and they just weren't really happy with that. And they were sticking up for themselves because they were taking, you know, the tag team title seriously, which Vince McMahon didn't seem to care of. And they decided we're going to pack our bags and go home. And that's what they did. And as we sit here at, you know, end of November, they're still not back. And there was some thought that when the Triple H regime took over, that there was going to be some headway being made. And it sounded like there was, but at this point, neither of them are back. And it's, you know, it's weird because, again, you have the new regime, and you also have the fact that Naomi's husband is in the hottest act in the company right now. And who knows if she was still around, that she could be part of that. Who knows? But two of their names, especially Sasha Banks, who's had this, you know, very kind of strange past few years with WWE and injuries and all these type of things. You know, we're sitting here, we still have no idea when they're going to come back. And if they ever will come back, it feels like they will at some point, but there's a question about contracts and how long can you freeze a contract for? So still a lot of questions, but this all happened in May.
Yeah. It's amazing that we're sitting here and there really hasn't been any, not only has there not been a resolution to this issue, we really haven't gotten a lot of updates on right. it. And think of how much in the landscape of pro wrestling has changed. Like you said, there's been a regime change. If they were really mad at Vince, would Triple H be able to kind of bring them back? I think the contract status of Sasha Banks and Naomi is unclear. We've discussed, there's been rumors that they've been released, that maybe that they thought they were released and then they really weren't. What kind of, is there a legal argument going through it? All these could have been great questions, I think, asked of Triple H during his last press conference, but
Correct. Yep.
alas, we didn't hear anything about it. And it's very similar. It's somewhat similar to CM Punk's walkout, both previously in WWE and now his estrangement within AEW. It wasn't public, as public as CM Punk's, obviously, but it was talent that was frustrated and left, and we haven't really heard a word from them. Like you mentioned, there was that kind of burial of them by the commentary team on that episode of Raw, which was probably something that is going to hurt a lot of feelings and could potentially be a sticking point moving forward. Like this at the time was felt like the biggest story of the year. And certainly you could point to Sasha Banks as being one of WWE's biggest stars. Realistically, I don't think WWE's women's division has been the same since Sasha and Naomi walked out. Certainly with Sasha, I think would have been hugely beneficial to have around, especially where you look at the summer where Charlotte has not been around and Becky Lynch missed time. And I think that if we look at Becky Lynch, Charlotte, Bayley, and Sasha Banks as kind of the four pillars or core four of that kind of new era of women's wrestling in WWE, three of them weren't around for most of the summer. The only
Right.
one that was around was, and Bayley actually was out for that time, still recovering from her ACL injury. So
Correct.
I think this had a pretty big impact on the women's division, and I honestly don't know if the women's division in general has really gone back on track since then.
And also Sasha being a kind of a crossover star, to extent, Star Wars fans being in The Mandalorian and has some aspirations outside wrestling. She was part of that she featured on a College Game Day pre-show. Or at college, a national championship, when she was featured in kind of the package, the opening package, things like that. So making, I think it's this, to your point that not a lot of stuff has come out, we don't really know what she wants. What does she want for a career? Does she want wrestling to be a major part of it? Does she want it to be a piece of this pie, and she wants to do acting and all this stuff, and she wants more freedom that she didn't feel that she has. I think there's a lot of questions, and to your point, we just don't have a lot of updates. They haven't heard from either person yet, and there's all these things of they were supposed to appear at a music festival or fashion festival, something, and that got canceled. It seemed like they pop up on the radar, you don't hear from them, and then whatever opportunity or whatever thing is happening just kind of just disappears. It's just a very, very odd situation that we're still sitting here all these months later, and we still don't have any idea of a resolution or if anything's coming. So I don't know. We'll see how that plays out. However, the other interesting thing I thought for the month, we're talking about the Bloodline, and you're talking about Roman Reigns and title defenses. Was Roman Reigns said he's starting to enter what he called a new phase in his career, and he was signed a new deal, working fewer house shows. Going to be off a lot of WWE TV and live events over the summer. He wasn't part of Hell in the Cell, and kind of again this transition of him being more of a attraction, but obviously he's their champion, and they only have it. The timing is interesting because they had just unified the titles the month prior to WrestleMania, and essentially you're taking one of your major pieces off the chessboard for potentially long stretches of time. And you see he's kind of earned it, and you want to keep someone like that fresh and not burn them out. But it was so much of a different thing than what Vince has done a lot of, where you at least the house shows you can understand, but at least TV, your big stars are often on like almost every single week. But one of your obviously your one of your biggest stars, if not the biggest star you have, is going to be off. It was just kind of interesting, an interesting transition to move into this and. Really, to indicate that he's just a bigger star than he was before, and he can call his shots, and he can say, I don't want to work house shows every single weekend, and work four events a week. I want to work maybe two or none and be able to call those shots. And really, to me, it kind of signified how well this run has gone leading up to this point. Again, it was going to get even better later on, but it, yeah, just again, a new phase of his career. It was, and it also had me thinking, is he starting to think about the other side of this? Is he starting to think about acting roles? Is he starting to think about going kind of the John Cena route and starting to, how do I edge into that type of life? And how's wrestling fit into this? So, I'd be interested to see, you know, a year from now where Reigns is in his life and all that. But, I thought this was one of the more interesting stories of the month.
Yeah, I mean, Josh, who do you think has had, all things considered, who do you think has had, like, the easiest career in the history of wrestling?
In terms of being, like, a top star?
In terms of just making a lot of money and not actually doing, like, a ton of dates.
Hogan stands out, but he did a lot of house show dates during his run, but he didn't wrestle. He wasn't wrestling 20-minute matches. He was wrestling 8-minute matches, right? You must have someone in mind, right?
Right. It's Brock Lesnar, right?
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Right. Exactly. Right. So,
yeah.
So I think unless you're like Bryan Danielson and you're really obsessed with like the art of performance of pro wrestling and you want to just wrestle all the time, I think every wrestler in a way aspires to be Brock Lesnar. Brock Lesnar had, for years and years, and still really does, has maybe the sweetest gig ever since he came back to WWE. He wrestles a few matches a year. He's the highest compensated person in the entire company. He's booked like a god. And he kind of just does whatever he wants. He, you know, if he wants to say, shit on air, he can. Like, everyone, I wish my job was like Brock Lesnar's job. Like, everyone should. Like, it's a great gig. And Roman Reigns is someone who spent years and years working a ton of dates and, you know, carrying the company as in that role, which comes with a lot of pressure, especially for, you know, coming on the heels of someone who is as successful as John Cena was in that role. And he saw firsthand exactly how Brock Lesnar was managed. And I'm sure he said, you know, once I hit 35 or whatever, man, wouldn't it be nice to be doing that schedule and being that guy. And I don't think it was surprising that he's teamed up with Paul Heyman. I don't think it's surprising that he turned heel. And I don't think it's surprising that he has pursued this goal, because I think that's what you would want if you're a top star, which is to work less dates, stand out more of a special attraction because you're not working as many dates. You're not being overexposed as much on television, which allows you to remain, you know, hot and less stale. It's a better gig. And if you can get it, if you have the leverage to get it, and Roman has reached a point in his career where he does have the leverage because of all of the years he's put in and because of the faith the company has put into him, it's a great gig. Why turn it down? Right.
Right.
And so I see this as him just kind of coming full circle and him also watching and learning and saying, man, you know, who are the biggest, most well-compensated people in the company? The people who aren't around all the time. If it's not Brock Lesnar, it's John Cena, it's The Undertaker, it's The Rock, it's Bill Goldberg, it's all of these other guys who are not there that much. And it's the obvious goal to aspire towards, especially if you're Roman and you've already kind of done your time and paid your dues and whatever terminology you want to use to say that he's earned it. Why not? Right.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. Too bad he didn't have an aspiring UFC career. He could do the Brock thing and just play both sides off them. Yeah. Brock is, as Davis pointed out, and I think so many people have noticed before, Brock is just, he's always in the right place at the right time when it comes to finances. And I always talk about, well, maybe I'm going to go back to fighting. And it's just this loop, you know, this loop of back and forth. And you're right. He is.
I think Brock Lesnar Brock Lesnar might have legitimately made more money in professional wrestling than any other wrestler ever.
It's very possible.
I don't know the finances, but when you consider guys are paid more than they were in previous eras. I don't know if you want to adjust for inflation, but I'm sure if Brock isn't the highest paid person on the WWE roster now, he's certainly pretty close. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's been in that position for 10 years. I'm sure he's cleared tens of millions of dollars at least.
That's right. All right. Yeah. Let's go over the rest of the list here and get your thoughts on any of these things that stand out. So Mick Foley said he was not bothered by the Undertaker not mentioning during his Hall of Fame speech. WWE Hall of Famer Nikki Bella. Now she was going to be hosting a celebrity game show called Barmageddon. Company released their Q1 financials and obviously record-breaking revenue. And Nick Khan pounding the drum for multiple bidders expected for their TV rights, which are going to be up obviously very soon. So he is, especially with streamers, he's very, very bullish on that. Big E revealed his C1 vertebrae was not healing optimally, according to his words, and he was hoping to avoid fusion surgery. So, again, still recovering from his May injury. Candice LeRae's WWE contract expired, and she became a free agent. Both Alexa Bliss and Lacey Evans made their in-person returns on TV. John Cena, we just talked to him, or just mentioned him. Boy, if we talked to him, that'd be sort of big. Signed with WME after 18 years with his former talent agency, and he said in an interview that he hopes to return to WWE soon. WWE revealed their premiere date for Miz and Mrs. Season 3. We talked about the tag team titles. So we finally had a unification of the tag team titles. This started with WWE not currently planning to unify them. Then a unification match was set for SmackDown. And again, this was originally thought to be happening for Backlash and all this. But in the end, the Usos unifying the tag team titles on addition of SmackDown. And of course, in a classic Vince move, a decision was made at the last minute to do just that. The company said they're going to unveil their second NIL group in the course of the next month, that being in June. Shelton Benjamin was out for an injury. Cody Rhodes versus Seth Rollins was announced for Hell in a Cell. The company filed trademark for the Bloody Brutes, but that ended up changing to the Brawling Brutes, which was later revealed to be the name for Sheamus's stable. Stephanie McMahon took a leave of absence from WWE. That would not last long. Spoiler alert. Mm-hmm. LA Knight made his SmackDown debut and got a brand new name, Max Dupree. Crown Event was announced to be coming to Saudi Arabia in November. The company's front office changes continue throughout the month. Again, as Nick Khan continues to get his people in place. The company announced that after initially going to be having Money in the Bank in the Las Vegas the stadium that they had held events in before, they decided to move to a smaller venue due to ticket sales. Again, this is going to be happening on the same night as the UFC show. Of course, AEW's Tony Khan getting a little dig in, saying it was, quote unquote, a genius move going up against Dana White and the UFC. Gable Stevenson is exploring return to college wrestling for the next season. Zelina Vega out with an injury. Jeff Jarrett back with WWE to live events executive position. That would certainly change. And then Mustafa Ali discussed his return to the company the previous month, saying you've got to control your passion. Thoughts on any of that?
Did Stephanie McMahon leave of absence would be gosh, that's something that will years from now will come out as an interesting footnote that right before she assumed control of WWE as co-COO and taking over for her father, she actually had taken a leave of absence from the company. And I remember at the time there was a lot of speculation about what that was. Never really felt comfortable engaging in that speculation just because it could have been a private personal life thing, and I feel like it was inappropriate. A lot of people were like, "Oh, she's doing a bad job." There was that hit article that went out. I think that would probably maybe that would come out next month.
Business Insider, I believe, right?
Yeah. There was a Business Insider article where someone from within WWE basically said that they were unhappy with Stephanie's performance and that Vince, the leave of absence is really Vince firing her. Maybe lost a little bit of credibility when she was immediately hired as the COO when Vince stepped down. But that stands out to me, right, as kind of the most notable story, especially given the kind of big and formal role Stephanie had made. Up until that point, Stephanie had been kind of groomed to be at least the public face of WWE for whenever Vince had stepped down. She had assumed a bigger role on things like the investors' calls and had been much more of a public spokesperson for WWE over the last 5 years or so. So her stepping down was a big deal at the time. And obviously that was kind of quickly nullified.
Let's one question. As far as the tag team titles being unified, I like that. I like when there's one goal in mind for each division, so to speak. That's why I like my wrestling. That's how I grew up on it. What did you think? Were you happy with them making the decision to unify the titles?
I guess my general goal would be to take the tag team titles seriously. Mm. And if you have two tag team titles, theoretically, it becomes more difficult to take them seriously. It certainly becomes more difficult for Vince McMahon to take them seriously because he has two things he has to focus on instead of one. Mm-hmm. And by unifying them, and by keeping them on the Usos for a while, they have achieved a goal of making it feel like it's important that the tag team championships are owned by the Usos and that theoretically, when someone beats them for the tag team titles, it could be an actually important moment, which is something that has largely evaded the WWE tag team titles for a very long time. So I think it's been a good move. I don't think it's necessarily because they were unified, because I think you could have booked strong champions on Raw and SmackDown and have a much more robust tag team division than WWE has. But given the accepted limitations of kind of WWE's creative efforts over this time period, I think it has really worked out.
All right, let's flip to NXT, and not a lot of big news throughout the month. There was a report came out that Roderick Strong had made multiple requests to be released by WWE, but those were all denied. Poor Roddy. Women's breakout tournament began. Damon Kemp was introduced as a new member of the Diamond Mine. NXT In Your House was announced for returning in June. Jordan Devlin lost a Loser Leaves NXT UK title match to Ilya Dragunov. That would be some foreshadowing for his coming to the States. NXT announced they were going to be resuming touring in June, that being the you know, the Coconut Loop in Florida, and getting some young green talent some work finally. Nash Carter, obviously he was released at this point, issued an apology for a Hitler photo that led to that release, and his first post-WWE indie booking was announced. Bryson Montana, a.k.a. Jacoby Brooks, debuted in Level Up. Bron Breakker revealed that Rick Steiner sadly was not interested in returning for a father-son tag match. Nikita Lyons suffered a partial MCL tear and a sprain. Devon Dudley was moved to an NXT coaching role. And Simone Johnson, daughter of the one and only Rock, got a brand new name, Ava Rain. Thoughts about any of that?
No, I mean, NXT, I think in 2022 is all about kind of rebuilding the image of NXT in this NXT 2.0 mold. So I think like it's a lot of debuts, it's a lot of new gimmicks, it's a lot of repackagings. And I think that's been kind of the story of NXT for all of 2022.
Certainly has been. All right, let's move to AEW/ROH. I'm going to combine these now. Because obviously,
whoa, Josh, they're separate companies.
I know. How dare I do this? Yeah, but after I noticed there was two headlines for the month for Ring of Honor, I decided to make that move so Tony Khan can send the complaints to the inbox. But we're talking about Sasha Banks and Naomi earlier, and they're walking out. It wasn't a walkout, but obviously, you know, the big news of the month with AEW was Double or Nothing, which happened at the end of the month in Las Vegas, returning there to MGM, I believe is where they ran it. But the big thing was, I was on vacation at the time, but not obviously too far away from what was happening. And there's this thing on Saturday afternoon that MGF no-showed the Fan Fest. He had a meet and greet set up, and I guess it was a case where fans had paid to attend. And MGF didn't bother to show up. And it was a really strange situation that evolved into, was he going to no-show the pay-per-view, that there was contract issues, that there was all these type of things. MJF would later reveal that the company did a wellness check to the hotel room. All these type of things. No one knew what was going on. Some people thought it might be a work. Some people thought it might be just a shoot. There was a question about this mystery plane ticket. I'm years from now, I'm going to enjoy reading the book about this whole story and then seeing the book about AEW and seeing whether or not the plane ticket thing was actually legit, or maybe it'd be in a future episode, season 28 of Dark Side of the Ring or something like that. But this was kind of just the whole thing, but that kind of was a really kind of took away from some distraction away from a lot of things. But regardless, the night was capitalized or punctuated rather by CM Punk winning the AEW title over Hangman Page, his first AEW title. There was a Tony Khan rant afterward at the press conference against Eric Bischoff for claims that CM Punk had been a quote-unquote a financial flop. Again, MJF no-showed the meet and greet. After the event, Khan said he was not going to comment on the situation. There was a story that the two were going to meet in Las Vegas on Tuesday, and obviously that would lead to a scathing promo, which we'll get to in the June wrap-up. And there was a report that came out that MJF was leaning towards leaving AEW when his contract was up. Wardlow defeated MJF in the opener, so right from the get-go, I thought it was smart that they had the match kick off the show because it was not this question that was going to loom over the show and distract away. Wardlow won him basically in a squash to earn his quote-unquote contract with AEW. Adam Cole and Britt Baker won the very first ever Owen Hart Foundation Memorial Tournaments. Athena and Stokely Hathaway and Roosh made their debuts on the show. Sting had to be pulled from the FanFest due to an injury. There was this whole Game 7 conundrum leading into Double or Nothing. Obviously, the Boston Celtics and in the Miami Heat. and they had to essentially make the show a little bit longer. There was some question about how they were going to stagger the matches so it didn't, the most important stuff would go on after Game 7. Tony Khan said it helped tremendously when it came to the pay-per-view buys. And also, Paige VanZant made her pro wrestling debut here and said afterwards that she was, quote-unquote, meant to be a pro wrestler. And I don't think we've seen her since, or she has not been involved. It basically just floated off into ether. Thoughts on on any with Double or Nothing, the MJF stuff, and all that?
Yeah, so unlike the Sasha and Naomi story, with the MJF story, we at least are sitting here now and feel like we at least have a resolution in place.
Yeah.
In the sense that they're...
He's the champ.
We know he's obviously the champ. He's obviously back in the company. What we don't know is that he's not a babyface. I mean, I'm sorry. What we don't know is if this was a work or this was a shoot, or was this a kind of a shoot that kind of turned into a work, or what actually happened. I don't know if we'll ever know the answer to that. But you're right. That whole 24 hours from the fan fest until the start of the show was this rollicking master, incredible wrestling news, social media moment, whatever you want to call it, where everyone was speculating, everyone was scrambling, trying to get the latest information. The plane ticket, of course, leaking out. I think I'll never forget MJF, you know, he walks to the ring and I think he's wearing like a Ric Flair robe or something to the ring, and he gets in the ring and he does like the airplane spin. And I just remember thinking that was like the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life when he was mocking it. And then he gets squashed by Wardlow. Like, it was not like a competitive match. Wardlow gave him like 20 power bombs and then that was it. But that's obviously what people will remember from Double or Nothing. I saw you did not include the Workers' Right promo.
The Workers' Right? What was that?
That's the Hangman Page promo where he allegedly alluded to CM Punk
Rid
of Colt Cabana, because that must have been in May, because it was a few weeks leading up to it.
Yes, that must have been correct. You're correct. Yeah.
So of course, Hangman Page jeopardized $1 million gate by those comments.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of the beginning of the end for CM Punk and AEW, if you really think about it, is him, this feud with Hangman Page and the mentions of Colt Cabana. It's what, at least publicly, kind of has set him off, a few months later. So I think that in a lot of ways in the long term will come across as very notable, is that this was the month where CM Punk's, while it was presented as the crowning achievement, he wins the title, kind of the beginning of the end for his time in AEW.
You know, what's funny is, I'm going through all these headlines and I found this one that was leading into Punk did an interview with, ESPN. And I think it might have been Mark Raimondi. And he said, this is a quote, "This is everything I dream pro wrestling could and should be." That was on May 27th. And yeah. I was thinking about this last night. Like, where was his, what was the general feeling backstage at that point? You know, if Punk was feeling this way, was everyone behind the scenes grumbling? You mentioned the Hangman Page promo, the Workers' Rights promo and everything. So was he just delusional to what was happening? Did he not care? Like, I'm fascinated, but he seemed very happy at that point. Things would change so much in a couple months. Was May I think to your point, is May the beginning of the end? Or was that, like, what was that set off point that all of a sudden turned him sour on what was going on? Or was he always that way? Or I was kind of, when I read that quote, I was, if we had said at that point, CM Punk essentially was going to be gone from the company after a huge backstage fight a few months later in September and, be done. I don't know. It would have been like, of course we could believe it, but it would have seemed like unlikely. And then, but yet here we are.
Yeah. I mean, it's worth saying, at the time, there really wasn't a lot of, there was a little bit of like scuttlebutt and like dark internet rumors that there was some, frustrations backstage in AEW, but really, like, if you were to go back in time, there really weren't any signs that this thing was about to collapse, that CM Punk was deeply unhappy, that CM Punk was really offended by the Hangman Page promo, which he obviously was. And so it would be very, kind of interesting to know what was the atmosphere like in the locker room. And maybe over time, we'll probably get some people who write some books, or someone will do some interviews where they'll feel more comfortable talking about it. Obviously, it's kind of on a hush hush for now. But I think you do raise a good point where it would be kind of very interesting to see what kind of the mentality was. And also, like, how many people, something we still don't know is how many people in that locker room side with CM Punk, and how many of them have kind of sided with the Elite, if you believe that those are the two clear divisions.
Right.
Where do the sympathies really lie in that locker room? We really don't know.
All right, we'll go through the rest of the month in two chunks. There was a lot of different headlines throughout the month. So debuts, as always, Cheeseburger, Tony Deppen, Yuya Uemura, Jake Something, Rhett Titus, and Leon Ruff all made their debuts on various dark shows. Killian Dane, I completely forgot about this, made his AEW debut on Rampage. There was a new behind-the-scenes AEW series in the works at TBS. Stu Grayson's AEW contract expired. He was unable to come terms on a new deal, started taking indie bookings. We'd see him again, seemingly return to the company during the Toronto shows, but we have not seen him on TV or in the ring for AEW since, so who knows what's going on there. Punk debuted on the FX show's Mayans MC. Fight Forever was announced as going to be available on both PC and was going to be available on PC. There was new footage released. W. Morrissey appeared on Dynamite for the very first time, facing Wardlow in the lead up to Double or Nothing. And it was also revealed that AEW was discussing Killer Cross being involved in that spot instead. The company suffered a power failure during a Dark Elevation taping, and two matches were affected. I thought it was kind of a weird thing. AEW to debut in Savannah, Georgia, and Worcester, Massachusetts. Worcester, Massachusetts, beautiful city. Darius Martin was out 6 to 9 months after a nasty car accident. Again, just tough injury run for those guys, and especially him. The Forbidden Door tickets, the pre-sale tickets sold out in less than 40 minutes. The rest of the tickets, I think they released sold out in like 5. So that was an instant sell for Chicago. A lot of anticipation for that pay-per-view in June. Tony Khan confirmed that Trios championship belts were made. Of course, there was no idea when those were going to be put up. Britt Baker and Adam Cole were appearing on a Sunday episode of Bar Rescue. Bret Hart was asked about a potential role in AEW, and he said, "Right now, I'm happy at home." Danhausen was set for his in-ring debut, again returning after injury against Tony Nese in an episode of Dynamite. Tony Khan confirmed that Grand Slam was returning. Dr. Martha Hart and their family attended Dynamite. They also attended Double or Nothing as well. Again, it's kind of the lead up to this this Owen Hart tournament, which lasted throughout the whole month of May. And one thing I was just thinking back, like notable things about the tournament, and I think the one that stood out was the Jeff Hardy Darby Allin match, because of just the insane bumps and all that, and just that overall it was. It wasn't as star powered as I thought it was going to be, but I thought we got some pretty good matches here and there. But if they really want to get into it, I'm interested to see what they do this year with it. The TNT and TBS GM that helped AEW expand within the company departed Warner Bros. Discovery as they make a lot of changes. And then this is a strange story. So Hikaru Shida was quote unquote injured and out of the Owen Hart tournament. But actually she said she was fine, and she addressed her absence and essentially like, she didn't seem that thrilled about how it went down. The storyline said she was out, and then she was like, "I'm fine." So she just was. It was kind of a weird miscommunication there between her and the company. And she's. It's funny, after her AEW World Title run has ended, they haven't really understood what to do with her. Like, she's on the dark shows a lot. Like, she's been elevated in some matches before, but it's kind of one of those things where you don't really feel like she's gonna get a World Title run again anytime soon, unless there's some sort of drastic character change or something like that. But that was kind of a weird footnote to the month. Thoughts about any of that chunk?
Yeah, if I recall correctly, I think Hikaru Shida had I think her visa need to be renewed or something like that, or her visa expired. And so she was back, and she wasn't going to be able to be on those shows because she was back in Japan. And I think she was working in Japan.
I remember that, but she was, yeah, maybe it's just something kind of lost in translation how the tweets were, but essentially they wrote her off as injured, and she immediately was like, "I'm fine."
Right, so. And I think she might have done that to explain why she's going to be wrestling in matches in Japan if she's supposedly injured and can't do the Owen Hart tournament, or couldn't do the Owen Hart tournament. The Stu Grayson leaving, I remember that kind of being at the time kind of a big deal because he was kind of like one of the first original AEW hires. to just not have their contract renewed. There had been people who had been fired or people that had left the company or something, things like that. But I remember that being a thing where it's like, okay, this is the start of AEW has brought in all of this talent since they first debuted, and the roster has swollen in size. Some of those people are not going to be brought back. And Stu Grayson was kind of like the first one. I think Big Swole was really the first one. But this was kind of I think, the start of at least the original people who are founding members of AEW kind of being let go in favor of newer signings or things like that. So it was, a lot of debuts this month, a lot of business stuff, a lot of announcing new markets, a lot of new titles either being created or being mentioned. It was definitely a newsworthy month for AEW. I wouldn't say that outside of I think the MJF thing at the end really kind of stole all of the thunder from everything else, really, on the Double or Nothing show in general. That's what I remember from it. And I remember that, and I remember CM Punk winning the title, and everything else I had to go back and look and like, oh yeah, this was the show that was like a million hours long and that they went long on purpose because of the NBA Finals game.
That's right. So the rest of the headlines from there, Jack Evans said, who had one of those talents that was released the prior month, or his contract wasn't renewed, said his contract made him a little soft. AEW talent were appearing on Carpool Karaoke, the series, so you start to see them getting out a little bit more, as we've talked about a little bit this month. Jim Ross signed a new 18-month contract with AEW. Miro appeared somewhere, which was in a trailer for a CBS series called East New York. John Morrison made his AEW debut facing Samoa Joe. Maki Ito was a Britt Baker's mystery opponent on AEW Dynamite, again leading up to Double or Nothing. There was this weird Bryan Danielson, what you call leg trap incident, where it was kind of leading up to the Anarchy in the Arena feud with Jericho Appreciation Society, where essentially his leg was like caught between the ring and the ramp, and some people thought it was a serious injury, but apparently it was just a work. But it was just kind of this weird thing where he was like, he actually thought it'd be funny to stay there for like 8 minutes or so and be stuck. This, I don't remember this. I included this in there that Toni Storm said she was talking about in an interview, her original idea for a WWE pie angle was for her shirt to be ripped off. Do you remember this at all? Did she get
I
hit
do
with?
remember it vaguely because I remember people asking her about the pie angle. Like, oh yeah, remember when they made you throw pie? Like that was the thing. You got pie in your face? And she said, well, it was originally going to be worse. And then someone came up with the pie angle.
Gotcha. Okay. Anthony Bowens said he was recovering following another knee procedure. The company filed the trademark for Blood Moon Rising. They've done nothing with that yet. Britt Baker made an appearance at an indie show, AIW Gauntlet for the Gold, which popped a lot of people that were there. Kyle O'Reilly revealed he had signed a 5-year contract with the company. Great O'Conn and Jeff Cobb appeared in an episode of Dynamite to help kind of start the build to Forbidden Door. Layla Hirsch underwent a surgery for a torn ACL. Colt Cabana, we talked about him a little bit, signed a brand new AEW contract, but he was earmarked for Ring of Honor. I wonder why. Kenny Omega gave an injury update, not expected in Las Vegas for Double or Nothing. So again, no idea when he was going to return. At that point, Gangrel making a surprise appearance on Rampage. Paul White said he had a second hip replacement surgery in December. Sad story, Jake Atlas arrested on domestic violence charge. Again, not sad for him, but the victim and everything. And obviously, there's just a really weird year for Jake Atlas. Mercedes Martinez unified the Ring of Honor Women's World title by defeating Deonna Purrazzo on AEW Dynamite. And then the company Ring of Honor finally trademarked for some potential new logos. Thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, Jim Ross signing a new contract with AEW, I think, is interesting. The interesting elements of that is, first, since he signed that contract, and I guess it would be a few months after he signed that contract, he's been downphased. He's not on Dynamite anymore, and he's been he only does Rampage, and he does about half the pay-per-views from what we can tell. So his new contract seems that he's working less, which is interesting, and also that when Tony Khan a few months ago was handing out new, job titles for people backstage, new coaches and things like that, it was Tony Schiavone was given a formal title for kind of talent relations and things like that. Jim Ross was not. So I just think it's kind of interesting. He signed that new contract, but it seems like he's doing less in the company than he was before. Now, is that part of the contract, or is that part of if there's other reasons that are a factor?
Right. Yeah, and I think you and I were talking about this a little bit at the aforementioned AEW show we went to. I would not be surprised to see WWE him go back there when this 18-month deal is up. Again, a lot can happen in that time, but it just seems to be, again, with the Levesque regime, I see them being a lot more open to, not having him back in a full-time role or anything like that, but just having that voice and having that IP almost from the Attitude Era, which so many people remember. I can see that. I wonder, it's weird just to see that they don't really have an idea what to do with him, or the idea they have just doesn't seem to fit. He just seems so muted on Rampage, and it seems like he's playing a character to me rather than actually being invested in what he's watching.
Well, he's bad now, is the big factor. He's very
Yeah.
forgetful and he doesn't like the product. And you can't have somebody, if you're the play-by-play guy or you're a color commentator, whatever your job is to sell the product. And he seems more focused on complaining about it oftentimes than
Yeah.
selling it. And look, he has more value to WWE now than I think than he has to AEW. I think that when AEW first launched, it was very smart to have Jim Ross calling the action on Dynamite when you have all these fans coming in and sampling the product. He having Jim Ross on your airwaves makes him sound makes you sound major league. It makes you sound legit. So that's something that I think benefited AEW at the start, but at this point, I think it's diminishing returns. And he's objectively, in my opinion, not good at his job. So I think going back to WWE and doing the, maybe calls a match here or there, maybe he calls one match in a pay-per-view, maybe
Like
he
a
calls like a
WrestleMania or
special,
something like that.
yeah,
Yeah.
maybe he calls a special match. You can have him, do stuff for if you want to record stuff on Peacock, you want to have him on a pre-show panel, all these things that I think he would, be better suited for at this point of his career. And I think he would have more value to WWE than he does with AEW.
Yep. Yep. Then outside of getting the tickets to the Jaguars games, I don't think he has that much fun. It doesn't sound like
He
it.
seems to like Tony and he seems to like the lifestyle. Like he moved to Jacksonville, he bought a house on the beach. Like, if he's making a lot of money and he's doing that stuff, I'm sure he could be happy in that way. But, I just, yeah, like I said, like I think he has more value to WWE at this point. And so if he just does become available, right, you said it's 18-month contract.
Yeah.
So he would be done by the end of next year. If he still wants to be on the air and things like that, I could totally see him going back to WWE. I mean, his career is, WWE being fired by WWE, going back to WWE, being fired by WWE. So this wouldn't be necessarily he's the Billy Martin of radio announce of television commentators. So
Exactly. We'll go through Japan. So a bunch of different happenings here. New Japan wrestled Don Taku. Live results. Again, event happened. Okada retained the IWGP World Title over Tetsuya Naito. Naito would later have eye surgery in the month. Hiroshi Tanahashi won the vacant at that point IWGP United States title. Taiji Ishimori winning the junior heavyweight title. Bad Luck Fale and Chase Owens winning the tag team titles. And then Tama Tonga winning the Never Openweight title. The show was marked by appearances by the Good Brothers, Juice Robinson, and Jay White. And Robinson, after it was essentially floated out there by him that there was going to be no contract extension, he was going to be done. He did an appearance actually with Brian Alvarez in Wrestling Observer Live, where he just so it was kind of a, it was a career crisis, and he just was like thinking about retirement and all that stuff. It was a big swerve, and he ended up signing a contract extension with New Japan. After all, four title matches were announced for New Japan Dominion. Top matches and participants were announced for the Best of the Super Juniors 29. Kota Ibushi, this is an interesting story. He expressed frustration with New Japan management via social media, and the company addressed some of those complaints, but said he was going to remain under contract. And at this point, we've still not seen Kota Ibushi back in the ring. Shinjiro Otani issued a statement, and again, still recovering and still paralyzed from the neck down. That story played out in April. Tom Lawler versus Fred Rosser for the Strong Open White title is added to the New Japan Strong Collision show in Philadelphia. The company held Capital Collision in the Washington, D.C. area. Juice Robinson, we just talked about him, winning a four-way to win the IWGP United States title. Those included Tanahashi, Will Ospreay, and Jon Moxley. Tomohiro Ishii picked up a big win over Eddie Kingston in a match that a lot of people really loved. Leo Rush appeared on the show. Still not cleared to wrestle yet, as he put it. and Trent Barreto was pulled from the show due to COVID. And the show aired on Fight, and they promised significant improvements for what they call due to some issues with the streaming show in April. The company revealed dates for the G1 Climax Story 2 tournament, announced a high alert taping for July for Strong. Tanahashi and Jay White were set for a match at Strong Ignition. And then FMW legend Saiji Tarzan Goto passed away at just 58 years old. Thoughts on any of that?
I mean, the major story to me is the Kota Ibushi comments and the Kota Ibushi situation, much like the Sasha Banks and Naomi situation, is something that we don't know. We don't have a resolution for it. We're here months later. Mm-hmm. He has not accused, you know, the Yakuza of being involved in New Japan Pro Wrestling for a few months, which is so things have kind of cooled down a little bit, but we still don't really know a ton about his physical state, his mental health state, if he's going to come back to wrestle for New Japan Pro Wrestling, if he's going to get released, is he going to end up wrestling somewhere else again? And it's been sad because this is someone who is, you know, one of the biggest stars in New Japan Pro Wrestling and someone with really incredible potential to be a star anywhere. And he's just, the last few years of his career have just been completely lost. And, you know, again, we really don't have that much more information. It seems like the last big update we got was in May when this happened. And since then, it's been very silent on his end. So I would consider that to be by far, you know, that's really one of the biggest stories in New Japan all year, is that one of their top stars, this guy that has been a top star for years and, you know, headlined Wrestle Kingdom and all of that, has been, you know, absent from the product and has been, you know, said some pretty sketchy stuff on social media.
We'll go through Impact. Not a lot here. Jonah and Willie Mack became free agents after their deals wrapped up. Josh Alexander got in a car accident. It was pretty serious. He said he was fine. Impact Under Siege. The aforementioned Josh Alexander retained his world title over Tomohiro Ishii. Mia Yim appeared at Under Siege and confronted Deonna Purrazzo, so leading to a Knockouts title feud there. The Briscoes picked up their first ever Impact tag team titles, defeating Violent by Design, and then Sami Callihan returning after a long injury to attack Moose and set up a multi-month feud there. The card for Slammiversary started to take shape. Alexander versus Eric Young in the main event. Ultimate X match and the Briscoes versus the Good Brothers for the Impact tag team titles in a rematch from April's multiverse of matches. Scott D'Amore invited Hiromu Takahashi to challenge for the Impact X division title, and then Rich Swann defeating Matt Cardona for the Impact digital media title, the biggest title in wrestling, at a Wrestling Revolver event. Not a lot there, but you know, just seems like kind of a typical month for Impact. Just keep on going. Some people come in, some people leave. The Briscoes had a multi-month run, and yeah, just kind of the same old, same old.
Yeah, I think of the Impact, I mean, I don't know what their real growth plan is or anything like that, but just as a company, especially in this month, is kind of indicative of at least flexing a lot of working relationships. Remember, they for years wanted a working relationship with New Japan Pro Wrestling, and they could never get it because it had gone so poorly during a previous incarnation. And you know, they had Okada in and they made him a Green Hornet knockoff character and barely put him on television. And, you know, at least in the past few years, they've done a much better job forging those relationships. And so you can have someone like Tomohiro Ishii come in, wrestle your big guy, Josh Alexander, on a pay-per-view event, and it comes across well. And I think those are steps in the right direction for Impact. Again, probably not really moving the needle that much, but it, I think has added some legitimacy and some credibility back into the brand that really needs it.
All right, now we'll go through the junk drawer. We'll split this up into two sections. So we begin with AAA, with Triple Mania 30, one of their three Triple Mania events throughout the course of the year, this one being in Monterey. Young Bucks taking on and defeating El Hijo de Vikingo and Rey Fénix in the main event. Sammy Guevara and Ty Conti winning the mixed tag team titles at that event as well. Jeff Jarrett is all over this shit, man. Jeff Jarrett and Vampiro appearing at the show. The semifinals were set for their Ruleta de Muerte tournament, where the loser would ultimately have to be unmasked. And then they announced the main event for their Triple Mania Tijuana event, which was Laredo Kid, Black Taurus, Bandido, Rey Fénix, and Vikingo for the AAA World Cruiserweight title and also the AAA Latin American title as well. Daniel Garcia won the PWG Championship by defeating Bandido at Delivering the Goods, and they also announced a return date for July with their 19 show. Lince Dorado made his MLW debut, Blue Meanie, new Samoan SWAT team, all at Kings of Coliseum. That same show saw Alexander Hammerstone defeat Richard Holiday in the main event, and then Taya Valkyrie winning their first ever women's featherweight title. They also announced the signing of Lance Inouye. Dexter Lumis, who currently is, of course, on WWE TV, he had been released at this point, was announced for his first post-WWE indie appearance. Vice TV said they were as committed as ever to Dark Side of the Ring. There were some questions about whether that show was going to return. Freddie Pinns Jr. revealed a plan to start his first wrestling promotion within the next 18 months. Glenn Jacobs got an unopposed Republican primary win in the mayoral race. That, of course, he's been doing that for quite some time. Will Ospreay, some news for him. It was announced he was going to be making his GCW debut at a June event called I Never Liked You in Providence, Rhode Island, against Nick Wayne. And that was a match that kind of been put into motion when Nick Wayne was denied the opportunity to wrestle at the January GCW event, kind of at the last second due to his age. And Joey Janela said, who do you want to face? Who's your dream opponent? And he said, Will Ospreay. And, you know, 5-6 months later, that match was going to happen. Ospreay also was announced to be missing Warrior Wrestling 22 and also a Rev Pro show called Epic Encounter due to a bad kidney infection. Malcolm Bivens addressed his WWE release and confirms that he did turn down a new contract. Tammy Sitch was arrested on 9 charges following a fatal traffic accident. Bailed out of jail during a DUI manslaughter arrest. State of Florida was looking to incarcerate her prior to trial, and then she was released and then put back in jail after having her bond revoked. Always ready, the NWA's next pay-per-view is taking shape with Nick Aldis versus Matt Cardona for the world title as their headliner, and also Taya Valkyrie making her debut. However, Matt Cardona tore his bicep at GCW Downward Spiral. Surgery was imminent, and no one had any idea what was going to happen with the world title at that point. Rhett Titus also got in a month of car crashes. Rhett Titus unscathed following a very scary head-on car crash. Ted DiBiase and his sons, both Ted and Brett, were sued by the state of Mississippi for misused federal funds. And then NBC renewed Young Rock for season 3 and also was going to move it to Fridays, going head-to-head with SmackDown, which didn't seem like the brightest move. And Rock's XFL signed deals with ABC, ESPN, and FX when their season was going to eventually resume. Thoughts on any of that first section?
Yeah, I mean, the Freddie Prinze Jr. concept, which we've heard about, you know, for a little bit, obviously, in May, he said he's planning on 18 months. Haven't really heard a ton of updates on that, and I'm very curious to know if that ever really gets off the ground. I really feel like as far as these kind of like lower tier wrestling promotions that have television are pretty oversaturated,
yeah,
and are very difficult for any of them to really stand out, even if they have kind of different gimmicks. And it does make me concerned about potentially Ring of Honor. If they were to ever get a TV deal, is there room for them? Obviously, they'll have a huge benefit being associated with AEW, and Chris Jericho is the world champion. I'm sure they'll be just fine. But I think like between, you know, Impact, NWA, MLW, there's just these companies that, you know, maybe they produce some good stuff. People, maybe you'll see a little bit of buzz on online about, oh, this match was really good or this angle was really good. But it feels so saturated that none of them can really break out in a way to really achieve something, you know, noteworthy in the business. Yeah. And I don't know what, if I really doubt Freddie Prinze Jr.'s, unless it has just an incredible television deal and it's on a major network, which I doubt. I just don't see that kind of unfolding, but it'd be interesting to see if he at least, you know, they at least run a show and get off the ground.
Yeah. I mean, how is it? I mean, the issue with all these groups, these second, third tier groups, is how do they stand out? You know, when you have the big two, and it's tough, and we might have talked this before, but is it a style? Like, for wrestling fans now, it is easier to find what they want somehow and somewhere. If it's hardcore wrestling they love, if it is the high flying stuff, if it was just, you know, kind of just traditional, there's no shortage of places to find what they want. The question is like compelling storylines with talent that they care about. And there's so much out there already. It can exist, but how is it going to be different enough to stand out, really get an audience that's going to be worth it, and also ultimately make the company money? I think that's a big thing. What itch is it scratching that isn't being scratched right now?
Yeah, I mean, it was one of the cases with like Ring of Honor in its last year when it was, you know, before it was closed down and bought by Tony Khan. It was that thing with Ring of Honor, which was like, and obviously they're taping during the pandemic and empty buildings, which is obviously a huge challenge to make stuff feel cool and exciting when you're attempting taping in front of an empty building. But it was always this thing. It's like, Ring of Honor can't gain traction. Ring of Honor doesn't have an identity. Ring of Honor doesn't have a hook anymore. The product's not bad. They have guys who are talented. They have long-term storylines that have, come to have beginning, middles, and ends. It's not like the product is bad, but how do you stand out and to attract eyeballs? It feels like it's impossible unless you have major television. None of these places have really been able to gain that much traction on online, on social media. And even if you do, like if you're like a Beyond Wrestling and you have over 1 million YouTube subscribers, that's not really, helping out your business at the end of the day, just because you get some traction on social media for whatever reason. So it's really hard to really stand out. One of the things is there's a lot of talent, in the sense there are many talented people out there that could be put into a position and do a good job, but there's a real shortage on people who actually are drawing cards. And a lot of that is a symptom of WWE being the only major game in town for a 20-year period, and the lack of creation of new stars and the death of the territories and all of that. Things, you don't have big name talents that can really draw available. Those people are highly sought out by AEW and WWE, and they're just not popping up on the independents, and they're not popping up, and there's not that one person that you can really build around. That's a real big star. Like it's not like CM Punk. I guess maybe CM Punk's not available, but it's not like there's no like CM Punk out there, or Roman Reigns, or John Cena, or John Moxley, or these real big stars. Those guys aren't around to, if you're Freddie Prinze Jr., and even if you have money, you're like, yeah, I'm gonna poach one of those guys to be the big star that's gonna anchor my company. It just doesn't seem feasible.
So finally, this second chunk was we round the bend. At this point, former WWE NXT wrestler Dakota Kai filed the trademark for King Kota. Tessa Blanchard was believed to be done with Women of Wrestling. The Authors of Pain, speaking of new promotions, said they were going to be launching the Wrestling Entertainment Series promotion, going to feature some former WWE stars, former UFC star and Strikeforce champion and kickboxing champion Alistair Overeem. Jonathan Coachman and Matt Rywald were going to be Raywald rather were going to be announced as a commentary team, or they were going to be the commentary team. And then in the same month, they decided to postpone their debut show, and ultimately had to cancel the makeup date. It was just a mess with talent pulling off and all that. But yes, quicker they come, quicker they go. Ric Flair announced he was going to be returning to the ring for his quote unquote last match this July. Ricky Steamboat, in an interview, said he declined an offer to face him after there was a report out there that he's going to be part of that last match. There's a lot of questions about it. Is it going to be a singles match? Where is it going to be? Tag team match? All these type of things. Tony Schiavone and David Crockett were going to be involved as well. And not coincidentally, StarCast 5 was announced for SummerSlam weekend in Nashville. A rescheduled Ric Flair roast was announced for this StarCast 5, and then also a Four Horsemen reunion. So kind of put together some of the dots there. Hacksaw Jim Duggan announced he was battling cancer again. Everyone's doing a podcast, Jesse. Kevin Nash launching the Click This podcast. Mick Foley launching Foley is Pod with Conrad Thompson. John Moxley, you just talked about him a minute ago, was announced for several indie shows. GCW, you wouldn't understand, defending his title against Tony Deppen. Also, The People versus GCW. And both he and Sammy Callahan were set to reunite at the July Wrestling Revolver pay-per-view. Again, they were supposed to team the year prior, but that got put off due to Callahan's injury. Joey Janela, I forgot about this. Joey Janela required help after hitting a flaming super kick at GCW Maniac. His foot was on fire, and he couldn't get the fire to go out, so that was quite a thing there. The company and IWTV announced their first Settlement Series event set for July. Kurt Angle underwent double knee surgery. Again, more GCW. Brett Lauderdale advised not to comment on fake COVID-19 test allegations. That was a whole thing I forgot about. Charlie Dempsey out of NXT UK was set for his Progress Super Strong Style 16 event. And then Bray Wyatt, who actually Freddie Prinze Jr. talked about wanting to be a major part of his promotion, if not the major part, said he was teasing an in-ring return. He said it's almost time, and we're still waiting for him to get in the ring, although he did return for WWE recently. Thoughts on any of that?
Yeah, I mean, 2022 was definitely the year where wrestling promotion was supposed to be launched on the power of NFTs, and collapse before it could start. So I think that's pretty a nice story, a very 2022 storyline, if we want to bury, you know, storylines from what was it like in 2022? What was it like for wrestling in 2022? We want to put those memories into a time capsule. I do think something very 2022 is, oh, the Authors of Pain tried to start a wrestling company based off NFT funding, and then it quickly collapsed and they never ran any shows, despite allegedly having a huge roster of high-priced people. The Bray Wyatt thing is at least interesting in the sense that I'd be kind of curious to know, like, he teased that back in May, which is a few months before he was be re-signed by WWE. And I'd be kind of curious to know, like, really, how close did he come to wrestling somewhere else? How close did he come to signing somewhere else? What kind of offers were made towards him? I'd be kind of interested in knowing how close he came to not going back to WWE because he went somewhere else. And if that was ever really a serious goal, like when he says, when he was teasing something, like, did he have a date planned? Did he have something on the, you know, set up, and then WWE came in and made a better offer? Or was he really just kind of, you know, trolling or just putting stuff out there to kind of stir the pot a little bit? I'd be curious to know, like, what kind of actual interest there was in him after he left WWE, because we didn't see him at all. He didn't do anything.
Right. Well, we're at the end of May. That was a good solid 65 minutes or so. Before I let you go, before we get a chance to throw you the microphone and do your plugs, what are your thoughts for the year ahead, 2023? What is interesting you the most in terms of promotion, news story? What are you kind of looking? What's piquing your interest for the year ahead that you're interested to see play out?
Oh gosh, 2022 is so crazy that I know. It's hard to imagine what 2023 holds in store. I mean, I think the two major things I'll look at is the directions of AEW and WWE. I know that's not necessarily rare that people are looking to see what happens there, but I think in WWE's case, a full year of Triple H's leadership, what does that mean? What kind of changes are made to the product? Does he start working more towards elevating new names and new talent up the card? I think that's got to be a top priority for him, is to find some young talent and really push them and really try to turn them into big stars and see kind of how that all shakes down. In AEW, I think we're going to learn more and more about Tony Khan's ability to be a sustainable, strong booker. I think he's done an overall very good job these first 3 years, but there are some, I think, red flags popping up over the last few months that the product maybe is feeling a little bit colder. Maybe fans are kind of starting to tune out. What can be done to kind of get them back into the fold? Part of me thinks with just in general, AEW's booking, and I haven't really thought that much about this point I'm about to make, so if it sounds stupid, just bear with me here. I kind of think that AEW in Tony Khan's booking style is so intricate and has involved so much stuff happening every week on Dynamite, and so many different feuds and different kind of matches happening and guys having histories with one another and all this, that as more and more content gets produced, if we get more and more hours of Dynamite and Rampage just in cumulatively since the company has started, that the storytelling apparatus for the company has become unwieldy. And it's become difficult to manage in the sense that there always has to be something happening in every single angle and every single match. And the fan base is kind of becoming burned out and becoming exhausted by it. And I think that somewhat explains why I think some people feel like the product is cold, or they feel like that nothing really important is happening on the product. Because I think if you watch the show, plenty of stuff happens that feels important. But I think fans are almost numb to it because they've consumed so many different angles and moments and debuts and big matches and crazy stunts over the years that it's starting to have a bit of a numbing effect on the product. I wonder how that plays out in 2023. If the company can shift, the company can regain some of that more wide-eyed optimism that they got from the start, or if we'll see more of the fans adopt maybe a more cynical approach towards the company than they have at the very beginning. And we don't really, and it's really, really hard to say, but I think it's something that's worth monitoring, and certainly something that I'm interested in looking at in 2023.
Yeah, it's important because obviously they're both companies are steaming towards ahead to get new TV deals, and one is in a much more powerful position because they're the industry leader. But this is, you know, it's a pretty important deal for AEW, and if I'm them, and I always, there's so much stuff we don't know happens behind the scenes, decisions and things influencing decisions and all that. But it's funny. Not funny, but it's something I noticed, and this happened at the Full Gear post event press conference as well. Is, Tony Khan doesn't like to be questioned about his balance in terms of all the different jobs that he has, and especially when it comes to looking at like AEW and Ring of Honor and trying to figure all these things out. And I think he takes it pride in being able to do all these things. But it's a lot of things that he has to do. It's a lot of different jobs. It's all these type of things. And with the Ring of Honor stuff, I think the company, from a viewing standpoint, I think it would be best served to extract that from AEW TV as much as possible. Because while the Jericho stuff has been fun, I think the titles have become kind of a crutch in a lot of ways because it gives people things to do. And that helps alleviate a lot of booking decisions. And you mentioned some of the intricacies, I can't even pronounce that word, because you're able then to be like, oh, they're chasing after a title. We can do some things there. And it doesn't have to be super in-depth. They have, things to do. And I think because they introduced so many more titles, you're essentially combining these two companies and kind of booking them into one. Where again, to me, your singular focus should be your AEW titles. And that was when I think the company was really firing. They had the benefit of debuts all the time. And I think that began to be a little bit of a crutch as well, because it was always it's funny, going through January, February, and March and so on in April, all these headlines of Tony Khan saying, someone big is walking through the forbidden door. Major announcement coming here. This is happening. This is happening. It was always, very Carnival Barker, like, this is coming. This is coming. That you have something to look forward to all the time. And in my mind, it was always going to be unsustainable because you can't keep introducing new people forever. You can't keep buying new companies forever. And they've kind of reached that point where they have to rely on the talent that they have. And I think to your point, this year is really going to show us what has he got, because, he's. There, I think the Ring of Honor decision, what happens after Final Battle, is fascinating. I don't. I am. I was asked by Andrew Thompson on the April edition, which we just recorded. He's like, what do you think about? Are you optimistic for ROH TV deal? Tony Khan did not sound optimistic at the Full Gear press conference. And he said, I think in the call leading up to it, he said that, we're going to make a decision on Ring of Honor after Final Battle. And he keeps mentioning Warner Brothers, but there's no. He's not giving any hints of like, I have something in place or something's coming. He's been mentioning Warner Brothers and talking about this since March, and nothing has happened yet. So I think there's just, in this era, it shouldn't take that long to get a deal made. He doesn't want to do the YouTube thing, but I think you might have to if he wants to keep it going. But I think kind of that it's at a loggerhead with all this stuff, and they have to figure out what they're doing with Ring of Honor. I think separating that out from a creative standpoint, just a what am I supposed to watch and really pay attention to as a viewer, I think that would help a lot, but we'll
Yeah.
see.
I think with the Ring of Honor and by connection, the too many titles, right? Very common criticism I hear I see of AEW is there are too many titles, and I don't care about Ring of Honor, and they gotta stop focusing on Ring of Honor. And I think for me as a fan, I don't have a problem with too many titles. I don't have a problem with Ring of Honor. All that stuff's good. I've seen like it's mostly quality work and quality matches. What's the big deal? But I do think that there's something to, like I said, kind of there's been so much happening in AEW since the start, and now just focusing on who's the Ring of Honor champion and what's this match mean and what's this angle going on with the ROH Pure title, or the ROH TV title, or the ROH tag titles in addition to all the other titles that they have. I think that it becomes not necessarily confusing for the viewer, but kind of unnecessarily mentally taxing, where I think in some ways fans don't want to have to focus on a million things when they're watching a wrestling show, and they don't the pacing of the shows with you know, all these segments lined up, boom, 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 nothing ever breathes, I think becomes a little bit mentally exhausting for fans. And sometimes you just want to turn on wrestling and you want to see three or four major angles and that's it. That's what WWE does. WWE has a 3-hour Raw and they have like 12 people who regularly show up on that show. It's just a different philosophy. And I think there's something to be said for, you know, the less is more ideas. Yep. And I think take Ring of Honor off of AEW, take the titles off of AEW, it becomes, I think, like from a fan perspective, a little bit easier to manage what's going on and to really care about certain things. I don't buy into the, and so that's where I kind of feel like I'm at a crossroads as a fan, where it's like I objectively enjoy this stuff. I think it's quality, but I also understand that it may be having a negative impact on the broader fan base. And that's something that I think Tony Khan might have to make a big decision on.
Yep. One final question before I let you go. About a year ago, we were doing one of these shows and we talked about Hook. And Hook being, you said you wouldn't be surprised if he was, I mean, it's a prediction, or you wouldn't be surprised if he was the biggest star in wrestling a year from now. And this was a year ago. How have you... He's in a much different position, or just kind of like still in the starting blocks in a lot of ways, not working a lot. And he's like not working indies or anything like that. He's just kind of like, he's just doing what he does every couple months. Thoughts on Hook about a year later.
If I recall, I said that there's a slim chance, and I wouldn't be completely shocked if he was the biggest star in wrestling by the end of this year, 2022. Just based on the concept that he was really over very early, and that there was a small window that if he was just pushed to the moon, he could really, really get over and become like this Goldberg-like phenomenon. That obviously hasn't happened. And one of the things I think we've learned over a few years of Tony Khan's management in AEW is that he likes to go really slow with guys. He likes guys to spend this whole years of building up MJF for him to win the title. You know, years of we're now starting to see people like Jungle Boy slowly get elevated up the card. We're starting to see, you know, these guys just kind of, there's really no haste when it comes to pushing guys, which in most cases is a good thing, but every once in a while, you just got to strap the rocket to somebody and gamble and hope that they pay off. And I think Tony Khan would be better suited if he did take that approach. But he clearly doesn't. It's clearly not part of his booking philosophy. And I think with Hook, Tony Khan probably has like a 4 or 5 year plan with Hook. And this is just year one is just him having occasional squash matches. Is that the best thing for his development? Is that the best thing for helping him get over? I don't know. I'm not a professional wrestling trainer, but I would say that it'd probably be better if he worked more frequently.
Yeah.
That being said, he's maybe not quite the new phenomenon that he was when he started. He's still very over. He's still very young. I think he's a really good wrestler at this stage of his career. He's very athletic, and I think he has a kind of hard to create natural coolness and charisma to him as a performer. And so I think he's still an excellent prospect, but I think the AEW is really going to take their time with him. And that might be frustrating for some fans, but I just think that's the way things are going to happen for him. Yeah. That's the way the company operates.
Well, before I let you go, chance to plug where people can read you these days, hear you these days, and the floor is yours.
Yeah. I mean, gosh, I've been doing so much, these last few weeks. So I have, voicesofwrestling.com, which is where most of my writing can be found. I haven't actually written that much recently, but that'll be picking up over the next few weeks as we round up the end of the year. So voicesofwrestling.com is where most of my written content you can find. WrestleNomics, which we record every Sunday at 11 a.m. That's live right on YouTube, but you can find it anywhere on any of your podcast app of choice. That's me, Brandon Thurston, and Chris Gullo going over all the business side of wrestling. Nobody going into as much depth as we do when it comes to the business side of pro wrestling. Also, WrestleNomics.com. Some of my writing is up there. I've written some longer form pieces more aimed at the business analysis of the business of wrestling, and not necessarily, you know, my favorite wrestler or my favorite matches, which can be found on Voice of Wrestling. And just Gentlemen's Wrestling Podcast. We just uploaded an episode this morning. Me and Joe Lanza from the Flagship Wrestling podcast, we talked about Triple H's first 100 days in charge. We kind of went over things we had noticed that were different, things that we noticed that haven't changed, expectations for his next 100 days, but really try to do an evaluation of what Triple H has meant to WWE so far and what do we expect to happen in the future. So that's the Gentleman's Wrestling podcast. You can find that right here on YouTube. Just type it into YouTube. And of course, probably the best place for now to keep track of everything that I'm doing is to follow me on Twitter at Jesse Collings, JesseCollings. I'll be sharing everything that I'm doing. And you get to see my tweets and my thoughts in real time, which is always valuable.
Exactly. All right. Good stuff. Well, Jesse, thanks so much for stopping by. And yeah, another great conversation about a month gone by in wrestling history. Jesse Collings, thanks so much. All right. Big thanks to Jesse Collings for stopping by. All types of cool stuff that happened there, as I think I've said at the end of every single podcast. And it's that was a busy one. April obviously was a busy one. Went 2 hours with AT, Andrew Thompson, then going, just over an hour, hour and 15 or so with Jesse. And always like his insight. Always love those conversations and hope he did as well. And yeah, June is coming up in a couple days. We have Mike Gilbert of Fight Game Media. He does the Brace for Impact podcast over there, but obviously pretty well versed in all things pro wrestling. We recorded that one. I like that one a lot. It was a first time guest on this show, and I had really great insights, and it was a good conversation. So that one will be coming up later this week. We have July coming up, and then August, and yeah, we're cranking. The MMA Year in Review series, I believe, is going to begin this week as well. Paul and I are ironing out the details of that. Paul Fontaine, of course. And yeah, should be some good stuff coming up. Big thank you to the gentleman or lady, whoever it is, that posted a Reddit thread about these shows and asking people to check them out. I greatly appreciate that. I happened to catch that yesterday as we're recording this, and that was cool. So I added some links in there, and I'll continue to add some links. And again, I just want more people to hear these. There's so much stuff that happens in pro wrestling. It's kind of cool to take an hour or so and look back at what happened in a specific month and just all the little things that happened. It's just, you know, if you had a mosaic of all the different stories that happened, it'd be wild how many stories make up these things on a monthly basis. And I mean, as I go over on the top of all these shows, I'm scanning through like over 500 headlines per month. And this is just from our stuff. This is like, you know, we don't hit every single interview, every single match result, every single X. I mean, there's all these things that happen on the actual shows that we don't necessarily talk about it here. So there's even more stuff. If you really think about that, you think about some of the world title matches and mostly kind of focusing here on the title matches, obviously the title changes rather, but we don't really ever talk about some of the other things. And, just a lot that happens in a given month. But yeah, May was a fun month. June's a good one. We're going to keep rolling on throughout the whole month. So that being said, I greatly appreciate the time you spent with me and any of the fine podcasters here on WrestlingObserver.com. Please keep spreading the word. Big thanks to Jesse Collings. And again, thanks to all of you. Until next time, insert catchphrase here.